Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo on this first Thursday of 2012, January 5th. Happy New Year, everybody.
And yeah,
here are the headlines we're dealing with this week. Iran, of course, back in the news and continuing to be in the news with the nuclear fuel rods and what's going on with the oil embargo and possible war as they threaten to, among other things, mine the Straits of Hormuz. MF Global reporting, or actually not being reporting, but having been found out to have sold assets to Goldman Sachs before MF Global's collapse. Obviously, my lips have not caught up with me in 2012. Ex-Federal Reserve Governor Kevin Warsh with a rather interesting editorial we're going to be covering. Plus, of course, the big news this week, and this is where we're going to kick off this week's show. The primary season is now officially open, and it started, of course, with the Iowa caucuses, where Mitt Romney won by 8 votes over Rick Santorum, a gigantic lead. But, of course, from our point of view, the bigger news is that Congressman Ron Paul of Texas is now officially a first-tier candidate. He was just a few percentage points behind, and he is, by all accounts now, a force to be reckoned with. We have touched on Mr. Paul previously, and I do talk about him a little bit more in detail. So, Gene, I know you've been doing a little background information research on Dr. Paul. What do you have for us?
Yeah, this is a little bit of his history, but also you mentioned that he came in third place. He actually, there was a quote by him that said he came in second since the first two people were tied for first. So anyway.
Spin City everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. His first lesson in sound money from his oldest brother, Bill, during the height of World War One, the Paul boys, I think there were three of them, were laying aside quarters from their Pittsburgh Press paper routes and pulling pennies earned from pulling dirty milk bottles off the line at the family dairy to buy war bonds. One day, one of his brothers, Ronnie, suggested what was, in retrospect, a rather Keynesian solution. Why doesn't the government just print this money? Bill, his other brother, responded, well, then the money wouldn't have any value. At the time, Bill was 10 and Ron was about 7. Paul says now that the Washington bureaucrats would really like the whole money situation to be complicated, and that we have to accept this complex monetary system of the Federal Reserve, but it's no more complicated than two kids talking. And it's not complicated, he insists. There are the themes he has been addressing. These are the themes he has been addressing consistently since he entered politics in 1974 over the course of 12 terms in Congress and his third bid for the White House. He believes in free markets, doesn't believe in the Federal Reserve, and he pushes a gold standard. It says he does here. I'm pretty sure he does. And government is the cause, not the cure of the nation's troubles. He quotes, if it tries to make us virtuous, and he's referring to government, and it tries to make us better people and fairer people and make us more generous and make sure that nobody's richer than the other person, it must redistribute your wealth. And the only way that the government can do that is by undermining our personal liberties. And he goes on to say, this isn't the purpose of government. The purpose of government is exactly the opposite. The purpose of government is to protect our liberties. At 76, this former obstetrician has 7 years on the oldest man ever to take office, who was Ronald Reagan. He has proposed to eliminate 5 of 15 cabinet-level departments, which are commerce, education, energy, housing, and urban development, and the Department of Interior. And the article mentions he has no problem remembering which 5 in reference to Perry's slip-up. He wants to recall American troops from all foreign lands, not just war zones, repeal the 16th Amendment, which created the federal income tax, and reduce his own salary from $400,000, the current presidential salary, to a little bit less than $40,000, the median salary of an American worker. His grandfather, Caspar, fled the economic wreckage of post-World War I Germany and went to work in the Pittsburgh steel mills at age 14. Ron Paul grew up on stories about inflation and the dangers of paper currency. Paul attended Gettysburg College, a small Lutheran school near the famous battlefield. He paid his own way using money earned from his job running the local student coffee shop and washing dishes at a fraternity house. In his senior year, he married Carolyn Wells. He went on to attend Duke University School of Medicine in North Carolina. He served 2 years in the Air Force as a flight surgeon and 3 more in the Air National Guard. He never did see any actual action, but he says he saw enough of war's aftermath to convince him the way we go to war so often is the reason that we have difficulty getting out of war. He goes on to say, my firm belief is that the founders were absolutely correct in going to war very, very cautiously, very, very rarely, and not by one individual deciding whether or not to go. He can remember the date when he decided to enter politics. It was August 15th, 1971, the day President Richard Nixon decoupled the U.S. dollar from the nation's gold reserves. He lost his first congressional race in 74, but won a special election 2 years later to fill the incumbent's unexpected term. Several months later, he lost the general election to Democrat Robert Gamage by fewer than 300 votes. He then defeated Gamage in 78 and won back-to-back re-elections. His pledge to never vote for legislation unless the proposed measure is expressively authorized by the Constitution earned him a nickname, Dr. No. In 1974, he ran for U.S. Senate and lost. 4 years later, Paul won the Libertarian Party's presidential nominations. He placed third with less than 1% of the popular vote, but he now had a national base. In 97, he retired from medicine and returned to Congress. He's been there ever since. In 2008, he made a second run for president, this time as a Republican. The 2008 race also brought Paul's closest brush with scandal. And this is kind of interesting because it goes on, and I'd like to get into this, on what everybody has been talking about. This is the first time I've actually seen the particulars. But he had a newsletter quite a while ago, and the controversy arose over statements that appeared in his newsletter. If you have ever been robbed, one of the statements was, if you have ever been robbed by a black teenage male, you know how unbelievably fleet-footed they can be. Another statement was that Martin Luther King Jr. was a pro-communist philanderer. And another statement was, homosexuals, not to speak of the rest of society, were far better off when social pressure forced them to hide their activities. And I actually saw just the other day, it was not a recent interview, but a few years ago, and what he said was that it was a newsletter that he was actually not an editor of. He was a producer of the newsletter, and he really regretted these statements, but he said he didn't have direct, I mean, he could have edited if he was aware of it, so he took responsibility for this stuff, but he didn't, he said it was, you know, he didn't have direct editing powers at the time and wasn't aware of the statements, so it's kind of an unfortunate thing, but I think it was a little bit out of his control. But because he's a good guy, and you know, he admits to it, and just wants to say he's sorry it ever happened, and he would have prevented it if he knew about it beforehand. So anyway, that's some history on the guy, and he did it pretty good the other day.
Well, I would say that probably the most interesting thing that comes out of that is at the top of your story, where you talk about what his 10-year-old brother did at the time. Giving him a lesson in monetary economics, and it basically made me think that we'd probably be better off with a 10-year-old in charge of the Federal Reserve than having Ben Bernanke there. And to follow up on that basic theme, let's go to Jake, who has a little story about another former Fed governor, Kevin Warsh, who came up with an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that's raising some eyebrows. Jake, what's the story there?
Yeah, last month, Kevin Warsh, a former Fed governor, wrote an essay entitled The Financial Repression Trap. And for probably most of our listeners might not be aware, the financial repression is a term of a title of an essay by Carmen Reinhart, where she pretty much says that, to sum it all up, she's a Keynesian economist. She sums it up by saying that governments in a time where they have massive debt will choose to inflate at 3% or 4% or what have you. And she did a scientific study of past regimes over the last century and scientifically showed that that's what they do. They once they have a paper currency, they debase it by printing more money. And by doing that, they drop the purchasing power of the debt that they owe. So it's kind of a way of, like, if I owed you a car or a piece of gold or what have you, there's kind of no way for me to debase that. I mean, I guess I could mess around with a car or whatever, but what the government can do is they can print up money and that way take away purchasing power. So he goes into talking about how the financial markets are in a bad place and, you know, there's problems here. But what was the highlight of the essay is he talks about how policymakers are deliberately obscuring market prices and preventing informed judgments, which is kind of odd to see from a former Fed government just going in there and saying that policymakers are really kind of messing around with the economy. And quote, in environments of financial repression, businesses are keener to retrench than recommit their time, energy, and capital to new projects. Also, government-induced prices send false signals to users and providers of capital. This upsets economic activity and harms market functioning. Markets that rely on governmental participation will turn out to be less enduring indicators of value. So what is this that governments are actually manipulating? Is it the stock markets? Is it the gold market? What he specifically goes into is that the share prices in European banks are being manipulated. Also, the entire treasury market is being manipulated just because the Federal Reserve continues to buy up these long-term treasury securities. He says he goes on to say that private investors are crowded out of the market when the Fed shows up as a large and powerful bidder. As a result, the administration and Congress make tax and spending decisions with huge implications for our standard of living, with heightened risks around future funding costs. He then goes on to say that even if the interest rates go up by every 1 percentage point increase, will translate into another $1 trillion of debt service over 10 years. So it's amazing here to see, you know, he's not coming out and saying, oh, you know, the S&P and 500 is manipulated or what have you. But he's coming out and saying that directly, you know, the Treasury market is manipulated. And he's also saying that it's harmful, which is kind of an unpopular line of attack from a former Fed governor. So
absolutely true. And in fact, it's also noteworthy that in 2009, he reportedly, at a Fed meeting while he was still on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, at a meeting, he actually made reference to how they need to keep certain kinds of gold swap arrangements secret. So the question remains, and you kind of touched upon it in your story, is it possible that he is talking about manipulation of the gold market? If so, that would be quite significant because, of course, gold is often considered to be contrary to what happens with the growth of the monetary system and the money supply, and that would be pretty significant stuff.
But he doesn't mention it specifically, I guess.
No, he doesn't mention it.
No, of course not.
No, never, never, never.
Yeah.
Well, we have a guest who's joining us today. Mark Bray from Occupy Wall Street is going to be joining us in just a moment. So we'll take a break, and after the break, we will find out what the latest and greatest news is coming from the Occupy Wall Street movement. So you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back. Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
Listening to A Progressive Moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee.
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at prn.fm.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward.
And we want you to come
with us.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of the dreams.
My name is Rachel Trachtenberg.
And I'm Julia Cumming.
Our show, Pure Imagination, is on every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Join us each week for the latest in arts, music, politics, through the perspective of conscious teens. If you miss a show, you can always check out our archives at prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Starting October 15th, A Woman's Perspective with Virginia Reed will be moving to Saturdays at 5 p.m. here on the Progressive Radio Network. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
And we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we're going to introduce our guest. In fact, I think, Gene, we're going to pass it off to you. I'll let you introduce the guest and lead the interview. Gene?
Okay, today our guest is Mark Bray. He's a member of the Occupy Wall Street press team. He's also a political organizer. He's been involved in the anti-globalization movement, the anti-war movement, labor organizing, and student and immigrant rights organizing. He is also a third-year PhD student in European history at Rutgers University, so he is obviously a busy guy. We want to welcome you, Mark, to the Freedom News Hour, and thank you for taking the time to join us here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. To start off, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, maybe some background, and how you originally got involved with Occupy Wall Street?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, I came out on the first day on September 17th because it sounded like an interesting kind of thing to participate in. I didn't really know a whole lot about it, and I found out about it on Facebook a couple days in advance. And I've been an activist, you know, since high school, involved in the things that you mentioned. And so it sounded like an exciting thing to participate in. And, you know, I have friends and family who have had the same sorts of problems with the economy over the past several years that many Americans have had, you know, like unemployment, foreclosures, and so forth. So I came down, and I didn't think much of it. I thought it was, you know, a nice march, a nice demonstration, and then I left to get Chinese food and went home. But as I kept, you know, keeping an eye on it and seeing it progress and gain more momentum, after a while, by the end of September, I said, you know, this is something that I want to put some time into and help to make it grow and get stronger. So I decided that the press relations aspect of it was something that I had some experience with that I'd like to help with, and so I just sort of started to talk to people that were already doing it about how I can help and get involved, and that's how it's gone since then.
And you got on that's the way you got on the press team.
Yeah.
And tell me, I'm curious about, is that actually how the original movement started? It was a Facebook type of thing?
Well, there was a Canadian magazine called Adbusters that put out a call for people to show up with tents and to set up outside Wall Street to protest, you know, what's happened with the financial situation over the past several years. And then some people took up the call and organized, had some meetings over the summer. And it was really a small group. And on the first day, there were maybe 800 people marching, and then a few hundred people that camped out. And even many of the people who were there the first night thought they would get booted out by the morning. But because I think of this sort of latent frustration simmering below the surface of American politics that so many people for a while now have really felt like their voices haven't been heard, that the issues that are important to them are not prioritized by the politicians, it's grown into something much larger.
And I'm kind of curious, you were attending school at the time, is that correct or not?
I still am, yeah.
Okay. Now, did you actually camp, or did you, because I was just kind of curious, you know, it's kind of a tough to be studying and everything and be down there and camping and...
It is, yeah. I'm a TA right now, so I have teaching responsibilities. I have academic responsibilities, I was going to stay out. The first night I was going to do it was October 5th, but then I had started getting involved with the organizing, and you know, I tried to sort of dress in a nice way, in a presentable way, to create a good image for the movement and be with it to be able to answer questions for journalists. So I realized that night by 8 p.m. I was exhausted, and it was going to be noisy throughout the whole night, so I just said, you know what, I'd be more helpful if I go home, get some rest, come back
get
in the morning and answer the questions. Yeah.
And was this common, like a certain percentage of people were camping and a certain would show up during the day? And
it varied. Some people would maybe stay there a couple times a week. Some people would stay there every night. Some people wouldn't come at all because they already had, you know, apartments in Manhattan or whatever. So there was a whole range of levels of participation.
Yeah. And Occupy Wall Street was the first such movement. Is that correct?
Well, in the United States, I mean, you know, it was patterned to a large extent on similar movements in Spain and Greece and Egypt and elsewhere.
And then they kind of caught on as far as the United States and in various other cities?
Yeah, in New York, it got going. And then October 15th was an international day of action where there were similar events around the world, and a number of occupies in the United States started their encampment that day. You know, a couple that come to mind are like Miami, Providence, some other places, mm-hmm. London, Seoul, Korea. And so they've sort of taken up the call and moved it since. You know, unfortunately, a lot of the local police in a lot of cities have evicted us. So we're sort of in another phase of the movement now, focusing more on actions and events and less on the occupation. But, you know, we're still going strong.
And what was the contact between the different locations? Or was there, or was it pretty much just separate locations, or...
Well,
was there any communication between the different cities and stuff?
Yeah, initially it was largely because we created a model that people wanted to replicate, right? So it wasn't that we set out to organize these other places. That was spontaneous. But since then, we've had a lot of ongoing communication with the other ones. We have sort of an internet platform called InterOccupy where people from the different movements in different cities share strategies about what things have worked, what haven't. We've lent each other resources. So, for example, when the Occupy Oakland group was so severely repressed by the police and Scott Olson got, you know, his head fractured from the tear gas canister, we sent out $20,000 and 100 tents to support Occupy Oakland. So we're trying to foster those communications, but it's not as if New York is any sort of official headquarters. We just
really
started getting going. And so we're trying to really encourage individual initiative all across the country.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious as how your interaction went with the city of New York. I know here in Portland it was kind of interesting because it was very cooperative. In fact, the mayor, I think he went down there every day, and, you know, they tried to kind of compromise, and there really wasn't any adverse situations for at least a couple months. But how did it go in New York as far as that went?
Well, in the beginning, I think we were allowed to stay largely because we were severely underestimated. I don't think that the police or the mayor or anyone thought that we were going to really stick around that long. So I think that they thought they just sort of weighed us out. By the middle of October, that was no longer the case because it was clear that we were becoming, you know, one of the biggest American social movements in decades, that this is a real deal. So around, I think it was October 12th, we first got notice that the end of the week, that Friday, they were going to come in and, under the pretext of cleaning, try to move everyone out. So we sort of sent out the word the night before people came down. So they were supposed to come at 7 a.m., but by 5 a.m. we had more than 1,000 people in the park. And so when that morning came, around 6:15 a.m., the deputy mayor announced that they had called off the cleaning, at least postponed it for the time being. And so at that point, we made it clear to the authorities that we had enough political clout, enough importance, that we couldn't just simply be brushed aside, and it was a great victory for the movement. So then you can see that the next time around, almost exactly a month to the day, November 15th, when they came, they showed up right away at 1 a.m. in the morning, gave 5 minutes notice to get your stuff out or you'd be arrested, and then they came in, bulldozed over things, pepper sprayed people, destroyed a lot of property, including laptops and tents. And then not only that, but they systematically prevented journalists from getting anywhere near the scene, even with police helicopters. They prevented helicopters in the sky from being able to see down on what was going on. And three or four journalists that happened to be in the neighborhood were arrested. So
Wow.
Yeah, you can see that really the idea of us having a peaceful demonstration in a park is somewhat of a threat to them, it seems.
And you were actually there during that, huh?
I got the text message at 12:30 from someone saying, boy, you know, gee, there are a lot of police accumulating. I wonder what's going on. Huh. And so I started to head down. Then I got the text saying that they started the raid. I got there like a half an hour after the raid started, and they wouldn't let people even within a couple blocks of the scene.
Wow, that's pretty. I know the Portland thing was quite a bit. They did. I guess they called it an eviction, but it was more cooperative. As far, there wasn't any violence.
And
that seems like quite an extreme situation.
Yeah. Well, they certainly wanted no, because they realized a month earlier that with enough political leverage, we could resist the eviction. So they tried to do everything possible to, you know, exclude the possibility that we could try to do that to make them look bad.
So now, there isn't a camping situation in I think in pretty much all cities, or at least most of the cities.
Yeah.
So how is the, is it mostly an internet thing now? How is the Occupation Wall Street progressing at this point? Is it turning into, you think, a political movement, or what do you think?
Well, the interesting thing about New York is that by the middle of October, we didn't actually have enough space in the park to hold meetings. It had become so full of tents and musical performances and all sorts of stuff going on that most of our meetings would be held at nearby off-site locations like cafes or public atriums, or we even had donated office space where we would have meetings. And so as far as the logistical everyday operations of the movement didn't really change that much. It was just the outer face that we showed the rest of the community wasn't there anymore. So what it's done is I think it's pushed us along the path we had already started on towards trying to have fewer, you know, symbolic actions that kind of showed that we're a big movement, and transition towards actions that actually try to help people's everyday lives, that get people involved in participating and not just being, you know, passive spectators to the Occupy movement. So, for example, on December 6th, we started a nationwide campaign called Occupy Our Homes. And so on that day, in about 25 cities around the country, we had actions where either foreclosure auctions were interrupted, or attempted foreclosures were stopped, or people were put in foreclosed homes. So in New York, we had a march in East New York, which is a low-income section of Brooklyn, where the foreclosure rates are three times higher than the rest of Brooklyn and five times higher than New York State. And we had this march with a lot of support from the local community that ended by putting a homeless family in a foreclosed house. So, you know, to some people it may seem small that it's just one family, but what we've seen since is really an influx of people who are having trouble with foreclosures coming to us saying, you know, we want to organize around this issue. How can we do that? Because the need is there, and people recognize that need, but many people maybe haven't had the experience with political organizing. So that's one example. Another example is we're organizing a student debt campaign that's really going to get going in March. And so I think we've transitioned from sort of trying to get people's attention, because, you know, we've done that with an amazing amount of success, towards turning that into tangible campaigns.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, how did they actually, or did you guys actually mechanically put a family into a foreclosed house? Is it?
Well, you know, the house had been vacant for, I think it was 3 years with no one in it, and so, you know, broke the lock, opened the door, and to renovating and put them in, right? It's an act of civil disobedience.
Uh-huh, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because I saw a news program on cities in kind of the Rust Belt, I think, primarily, and I can't even think of, it wasn't Detroit, but similar type situations. And there, the cities were actually paying to bulldoze empty houses, which I just thought was almost absurd.
Bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, and they're doing this because they're vacant and nobody wants to put any money into them, but, you know, I don't think they attempted to give them away or anything, but they were actually bulldozing, you know, hundreds of houses in it.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, what does it say about our society that we have all these homeless people and empty houses, you know, that we have overcrowded classrooms, but empty school buildings, that for some reason the resources that people need are being systematically kept from them. And those are the kind of questions we're trying to encourage people to ask and to come up with creative solutions in their communities to somehow take steps towards addressing them.
Yeah, and from a libertarian point of view, I think a libertarian would say, why are we spending taxpayers' money to bulldoze something that would have value to somebody?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that no matter what your political perspective is, there's something that could be done better with those houses than knocking them over, sure.
Yeah. Tell me, there's been some comparisons with the Tea Party. In fact, I saw an interview that had a commentator, and then it had just a member of the Tea Party and a member of the Occupy Wall Street. And they actually agreed for about 2 minutes. the first 2 minutes of the 20-minute interview. And the point they agreed on, I think the Tea Party lady actually said, well, look, you know, we're looking at the same thing. We're looking, you know, you're talking about big corporations. We're talking about, you know, giving taxpayer monies to these giant corporate banks. And we're against that. So they agree for about 2 minutes. And then they spent 18 minutes shouting at each other about, you know, who was getting funding from who, which really had nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
But what are your views on some of the comparisons with the Tea Party and your thoughts on the Tea Party?
Well, it's certainly correct that both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street are responding to many of the same frustrations, the sense that, you know, there's this big unaccountable government that is more interested in helping our corporations than regular hardworking Americans. The sense that we need more local control over decisions that affect people, that people need to be more empowered to control their own communities. But I think the way that the two groups go about trying to improve the situation is, you know, structurally fundamentally different, right? Like the Tea Party is a political party. They ran candidates with a good amount of success towards getting in office and pushing the Republican Party to be, you know, more free market oriented, to be less you know, involved in government spending and so forth. Occupy Wall Street's a social movement, and so that doesn't necessarily mean that people shouldn't or can't participate in politics and vote for candidates, but what we're trying to do is have an independent, nonpartisan, non-sectarian social movement that focuses on the issues like unemployment or, you know, medical care or health or student debt. And That way, regardless of which candidates are elected to office, whichever politicians are in office, we can kind of focus on the issues and light a fire under these politicians to do something about it. So it's sort of a different perspective on what's wrong and what's right, and a different angle to go about doing it.
Not, and as you say, not necessarily political then?
Well, not in the traditional sense of trying to tell people who to vote for, because, you know, prior to Occupy Wall Street, there had been third political parties, there had been, you know, unusual sorts of Democrats or Republicans, and yet part of why this movement has gotten so much attention is because we're trying to take a step back and say, okay, what do we as the 99% of Americans need to have a good quality of life? And I think that if we have sit down and have a conversation about it, we'll find that most people will say that we need similar sorts of things. So how can we organize together towards trying to get them and cut away all the labels of liberal and conservative or what have you, and look at things in a common sense manner of, like, how can we make things work for hardworking families? Most of the things that we're talking about are really not all that unusual. It's just that so much of the partisan politics gets in the way of it.
Yeah, that kind of brings up... did I interrupt somebody there?
I was just going to ask a question. Mark, you've mentioned a couple times now the student debt issue and how there's something coming up in March, and you kind of left us hanging there, so I'm kind of curious to know what's coming up in March. But specifically, of course, where student debt is concerned, it can't be discharged through bankruptcy court or anything like that, so it's a very serious issue. What is the approach that Occupy Wall Street is going to take towards student debt?
Well, it's a mix of elements. I mean, on the more modest level, we're simply trying to educate people about just how expensive university education is in the United States as compared to many other developed countries. And in addition to that, how even the rates of student debt and the degree to which graduates are indebted has drastically increased over the past 20 years, right? Those are things that, in my experience talking to young people, they just simply don't know. And so if all you know is that going to college is going to put you in the poorhouse unless you get some sort of high-paying job, it's hard for people to envision an alternative to that. But more concretely, there's a campaign online organizing 1 million people for student debt payment refusal. So basically trying to get a strong social base behind the idea that you know, until change comes, we're as a group not going to pay. And so if that could actually work, and there's already a lot of signatures and a lot of ground-level organizing for that, it would really put a shock into the economic and political system behind it and you know, push people to rethink, why is it that we don't put more resources towards education, which, of course, is the foundation of everything, really, and how we organize ourselves as a society. And then, of course, on the more local level, we're going to have a lot of, you know, protests, potentially administration building occupations at a local level. So really try to put that at the forefront of, you know, how we think of our society.
It's early days, of course, but you mentioned this idea of organizing masses of people refusing to make payments on their student debt.
Mm-hmm.
Even in this early stages, can you give us some idea how many people have actually signed on to the idea?
Well, we've had thousands of people sign on the campaign online. Now, of course, it's very different to sign a petition saying you'll do it and then to actually do it.
Right.
So, you know, we're using that largely as a tool towards spreading awareness, but until you actually, at the grassroots level, go to student organizations and go to, you know, concrete people that you can actually see and talk to, you don't know what they're going to do. So what we're trying to do is put more energy into that. And we've had a lot of success at universities and among recent graduates sort of tapping into networks largely associated with Occupy, but even taking steps beyond that to local colleges to get people involved. And I'm not one of the main organizers of that campaign, but from what I've been told, the progress has been very encouraging.
Wow.
And in part, just to add on, there are a lot of people out there who simply aren't even in a position to pay their debts, even if they wanted to. So in a certain sense,
they're going to join right in, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, yeah.
They join whether they want to or not.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they're
right.
Already,
yeah.
They're at the forefront. And is that similar to, I know you had the bank transfer day?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bank transfer day was pretty successful. And I think a lot of people, even prior to Occupy, didn't know about credit unions or hadn't thought about the power they possessed as a consumer to determine how their money's held. And those are the kinds of practical steps we're encouraging that people can do that are different from casting a vote for a politician, because I think that the American political culture has made people think that really if they're frustrated with something, all they can do is look to a candidate to change a law. But there's so much more to civic participation and really being a participant in a democracy than voting for a candidate.
So there's... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just coughed. Go ahead.
There's a greater sense than that maybe voting for a candidate doesn't do anything for you. Is that true or not?
It depends on who you ask. And, you know, my role as a member of the press team is to try and reflect the diversity of opinions. There certainly are people of that opinion. But I think the more center of gravity perspective is that people had a lot of hopes for Obama in 2008 that he would be a different sort of candidate after the Bush years. And in very substantive ways, he hasn't. I could go into it, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners feel similarly. And so there's this frustration and desperation that people who for so long have put all of their political chips into the question of who they're voting for about what they're going to do. And so we've seen that with the financial crisis, the response of Bush and Obama were essentially similar, that they were going to put all their energy into bailing out financial institutions regardless of what happens to regular everyday Americans. And so what we're trying to do as a social movement is we're trying to acknowledge the fact that yes, in order to be able to be elected to high office in this country, you need to have millions of dollars in campaign contributions. You need to essentially put yourself in a position where you cannot possibly be expected to be objective and non-biased when you're called upon to regulate those very same industries and institutions that got you in office. And so part of the critique is not only the politician, but the system that they're working within. And our social movement is trying to shed light on these issues and call upon the entirety of society to think of new ways that we can do this, where the result is not that every time the market crashes, people lose their entire livelihood. There's something wrong with that, and it would be really short-sighted to think we can't do better than that.
You mentioned before about the banking thing, changing over to credit unions and so forth, and I previously on an earlier show made the observation that there is a weak point to doing that, which is a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of this, but small banks and credit unions actually have a much higher rate of default in an era where the FDIC basically, I mean, Jake can give me the exact figure, I think it's about 0.12% of their overall risk is what they actually have in terms of dollars on hand. You're definitely taking a risk when you're putting your money into a smaller bank. So I'm just wondering, how cognizant are the people of Occupy Wall Street about that fact?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert about that. It seems like you are more well-versed on that issue than I am. Certainly, there is an awareness that there is no perfect solution to this, that there are pros and cons to both directions. And, you know, personally, I see that as potentially, you know, a good small step, but that the issues that we're facing are much more structural and systematic as to the relationship between economics and politics more generally. So, you know, I'd have to look into that more. Perhaps maybe it's not the ideal solution, but, you know, ultimately it's one small step in many things that we're doing.
Well, just for background, the credit unions themselves are insured not by the FDIC, but by the National Credit Union Administration, which is just another government agency. It's actually the FDIC currently has somewhere like a penny for every $100 you have in a bank, so it's not really insurance in any way or fashion. But the cool thing about credit unions that you can possibly share with your group is that you can go in and look at the balance sheets. I can download a financial performance report and see just how badly exposed they are to things, because not all credit unions are the same. Like a lot of the small local ones that are like, you know, for closed groups tend to be a lot safer of a place to store your money, just because they don't loan out so much else, and they don't have all these wacky derivatives and what have you that, say, you know, a mega bank like Bank of America or Citigroup does. So they are a lot more transparent, but at the same time, you have to be a little bit careful, because some of the credit unions, and that's why it's pretty unfair to generalize, some of the credit unions are, as Walt was alluding to, are like completely horrendous and far worse than any bank, really.
Yeah.
It's only a matter of time before they go bankrupt.
Yeah, well, that's good information to keep in mind. I would hope that the people who are more actively organizing the bank transfer days are up on that. And I know that with that, we gave people suggestions for good credit unions to look into. So, but those are good, you know, concerns to keep in mind. Sure.
There, you know, it has. I don't know if it's actually, you know, all due to the bank transfer day. I'm sure it isn't, but we're members of the local credit union here, and I was talking to the manager just a couple of weeks ago, and he was mentioning how they've gotten tons of business from Chase in the last year, and Chase bought Washington Mutual, which was just huge in Oregon here, so they have a big presence, and I know Chase is always, which is J.P. Morgan, is always pushing their you know, special deals if you open a bank account, so I think they are seeing, you know, movement from, in this instance, Chase or J.P. Morgan to the local credit union. So it is doing something.
Yeah, I think that the general statistics show that there has been an increase in people putting their money in credit unions, and also just a more general frustration with bank policy. There was the backlash against some Bank of America fees that they had to withdraw.
So,
yeah, I think that certainly there was a larger climate of frustration with the banks, which is partly why Occupy got going, but we've helped to spur it along.
Well, Walt, Jake, did you guys have any other questions? Or
I would say at this point, you've given us a lot of very useful information. Thanks for sharing it. Does Occupy Wall Street have a particular website that shows to the public where people can learn more information, or what's the best way that people can just find out more about what you guys are up to?
Sure. Yeah, I would go to OccupyWallST.org, so that's OccupyWallST.org. And that started out as the New York City site, but we're trying to turn it more into a site that has information about all the Occupies. So that's where I would tell your listeners to check out to start.
Any social media they should know about?
You know, honestly, I'm a little behind on the social media. I have Facebook, but I'm not up on the Twitter. But if you search around, I'm sure they'll be able to come up with a plan.
That's all right. I don't like it too much myself either, but PRN always wants us to push the social media, so
yeah.
That's why I'm mentioning it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Best of luck to you and your – I hesitate to know it's all very decentralized, but to your associates, shall I say, and we look forward to hearing what's going to happen, particularly in March. It sounds like there's going to be some big stuff happening.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Aka.
Thanks for joining us on the program. We'll be back after these messages here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, Mike Fader here. I wanted to tell you about my weekly show on PRN called The Turning Point. It's on every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The show is basically live, spontaneous audio performance art. It's about striving, failure, and success, and then starting all over again. It's essentially about the simple heroism of making it through the day. If I do it right, it's funny, it's sad, and hopefully entertaining. Take a walk with me, Mike Fader, on The Turning Point, Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. All shows will be available on the archives. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, it's Paul Cavalcante with The Vinyl Experience. Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern and anytime in the archives. The Vinyl Experience. Great recordings spun from LP records. The culture of recording. Hi-fi and record collecting. Lots of cool music from the motherlode of record albums that I've built up through the years as a DJ on New York City radio. The Vinyl Experience. It's a blast from the past, present, and future. CDs, cassettes, 8-tracks have all come and gone, but vinyl is here to stay. The Vinyl Experience, Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern at PRN.FM. Give vinyl a spin. Load your iPod with past shows from the archives. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Honesty Without Fear, the Whistleblowers Radio Hour on Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
After every scandal, we learned that there were citizens who tried to alert the public, but were silenced and retaliated against.
I did not grow up wanting to become a whistleblower, but it was my job and my moral obligation to demand that truth and justice be honored.
Hear from leading whistleblower lawyers about how you can protect yourself if you expose waste, fraud, or corruption.
This country would be a much better place when we all recognize the contributions that whistleblowers make to our society and protect them from retaliation.
Learn from prominent whistleblowers who've lived through it.
Support those who protect you.
Whistleblowers are key to holding government and corporations accountable. Empower yourself. Know your rights.
Tune in to hear me interview some of our nation's heroes.
Tune in to Honesty Without Fear, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Wait up, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, and just to remind you, you can always check out what's the latest and greatest on our program by looking at our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. Also, I've been informed by the social media gurus at PRN that we now have our own Facebook page. You can actually just go to Facebook and do a search on Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. The exact address is www.facebook.com/pages/ The Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, / a bunch of numbers. So it's actually easier to do it by just typing in the name. I'll also get a link up on our website, so we'll be able to get you that way, too. And that's a new step forward for us here on the Freedom News Hour. Getting back to what we were talking about, first with Occupy Wall Street, and then before that, before the first break, the Federal Reserve, of course, plays a major role in what has led up to the financial crisis and, of course, the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement, and it continues to be a major portion of what we talk about here on the show. Well, lately, over the last year or two, they made a lot of noise about transparency, and Jake, you have some interesting details about that.
Right. A recent headline out of Bloomberg is that the Fed is showing its interest rate forecast for the federal fund rate into the future in an effort to boost transparency. Now, again, this has nothing to do with the $16 trillion in loans that they put out.
No, there's no $16 trillion.
Yeah, just a few trillion. And we really don't know. We do know that the Fed announced massive dollar swaps with European central banks to help out bail out the European banking system. And we don't know which of those banks are getting that money. But what they are doing is they're trying to forecast, and starting with the January 24th and 25th meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, They will attempt to publish the first forecast of the federal funds rate, which is at near zero currently, about 0.1% into the future. The idea is they're hoping to boost economic growth by delaying expectations for an increase in the benchmark rate, which really, again, only has one way to go up. It's so close to zero right now.
And, really? Can it go negative? Or?
Yeah, not quite yet. But I think they one of the European central banks tried it and it didn't work. So stop it.
Take the money, please.
But this, again, the whole idea is they've already published, Ben Bernanke is on record and saying that they don't expect to raise the interest rate until mid-2013, so really like 18 months from now. So I don't think this forecast is really going to add much in there. I think what it is is it's trying to get businesses to spend a bit more if they think they can have loose credit. More in the future, which is kind of what the Fed always does to try and game the system. But again, there is no promise. Obviously, there will be some major event, and you could easily see the Fed, needing to raise the interest rate or what have you. But they kind of have their backs against the wall because, again, any interest in the interest rate will start to constrict the banking system and will also lead to a debt crunch with the treasuries that we keep buying up by the Fed.
Absolutely.
So it's not a good situation.
Not a good situation at all. And interestingly enough, during the break, you texted me, in quotes, transparency, and I asked you what you meant, and you said, well, because, not really transparent. And you're absolutely right about that. In fact, it occurred to me as I was reading the articles about this whole topic this week, that really what they're trying to do is to redirect attention. If you get everybody's attention over on what they're doing with the interest rates, you're going to be a lot less likely to notice what they're doing with the money supply.
That's true. And I mean, who they're giving the money
supply
to.
That's what I think it's really all about. And, in fact, it was a very interesting article that appeared on Forbes.com by a former Bank of Dallas Federal Reserve President, Bob McTeer. It was entitled, Through the FOMC's Looking Glass, An Orgy of Transparency. And he was basically taking the Fed to task for becoming more transparent. It just struck me as I'm reading it. I won't bother to go through what he had to say because it was mostly a bunch of you-know-what. But as I'm reading it, it just occurred to me, this is somebody who is playing a role of being the critic of transparency, so once again they can continue to divert our attention away from what's really happening, keep our attention on this whole question of whether or not the Fed should be telegraphing what's going on with the interest rates.
Yeah, it's just like most of the politicians, they'll be hand-waving wildly in front of you, but what you really should be paying attention to is what they're doing with their other hand, which is behind their back.
That's right.
Or in your pocket.
Or in your pocket.
Which is even worse.
Yeah.
Or perhaps knocking down your house, depending on what you're
looking at. Yeah, with their bulldozers.
With their bulldozers. Well, speaking of bulldozers, why don't you give us a little overview, Gina? What's going on with President Obama and his strategy for a so-called leaner military?
Yeah, I'll sum this up. This was supposed to come out today; may have already come out. It's a revised U.S. military strategy, and basically, what they're doing is forecasting $450 billion in defense cuts over the next 10 years. And so they're kind of trimming back, and what they're going to trim back there, and I think to sum it up, they basically admitted that these two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq was a huge mistake, and they're going to move to a more of a situation where they're going to protect they're going to kind of ignore the Middle East a little bit, de-emphasize ground forces, and they're shifting the emphasis to the Pacific. And China and the trade passages there, they're very fearful of China for some reason, that they're going to just stop, people from going through the China Sea. I don't see it in here. So, and that's going to be more the emphasis on both China and, of course, Iran, which they're also fearful of. So scaling back the ground forces, which are very, very expensive, ground operations, and moving to more defensive, I guess, the Navy. And It goes on to say, out of an annual defense budget of nearly $700 billion, military salaries, health care, and pensions account for an estimated $181 billion. So this is something they're also going to have to face. And it puts to the point the government will eventually be faced with a decision between buying weapons or paying out benefits. And actually, I'll go for the benefits over weapons, but that's just my opinion. So that came out today from the administration.
Not terribly surprising, I suppose. But
it is a shift.
What's that?
It is a little bit of a shift, I suppose.
Well, yes.
Of
okay.
Sorts. Yeah.
We'll just go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left. I did want to touch on the story that you have, Jake, about MF Global, because even though that still is relatively below the radar for most people, it's possibly turning into a very serious situation. And there is the latest news about what MF Global did with their assets with Goldman Sachs just before their collapse.
Right. And again, the head of MF Global at the time was John Corzine, former governor of New Jersey and former CEO of Goldman Sachs. It was just released by Reuters on January 3rd that MF Global sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of securities to Goldman Sachs in the days leading up to its collapse, according to two anonymous former MF Global employees that stated they had direct knowledge of the transactions. It did not receive payment from its clearing firm, which was J.P. Morgan Chase, another name that's kind of mixed up whenever you have these big snafus. And the sale of securities to Goldman occurred just days before they filed for bankruptcy on October 31st. And at the same time, that they were doing this with J.P. Morgan with the Goldman Sachs deal, the MF Global firm was drawing down on $1.2 billion, a revolving line of credit, when it then crashed and burned and declared bankruptcy. So, you know, it's unclear at this point what type of the assets were bought by Goldman Sachs from MF Global. The securities were worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and again, the amount that was left in escrow was never released by J.P. Morgan until after the bankruptcy. MF Global customers still have not yet received an estimated $900 million worth of cash and their trading accounts, which remain frozen as the regulators look around for exactly where the money went. And the last thing, I guess, of interest is George Soros, his fund swooped in to buy on the cheap some securities sold by MF Global that dealt with European sovereign debt. He bought them at a steep discount during the major panic. So, you know, again, we report on John Corzine when he testified in Congress. He said, you know, I don't know what happened to the money. I have no idea. It's a, kind of a travesty, and I don't think we know the whole story yet, but hopefully with time it will become more clear.
And unfortunately, time is what we're out of, so we're going to have to pick up on the Iran story next week. But Jake and Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, hopefully we aren't at war with them by then.
Hopefully
we better
not.
Be.
We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Take care,
everyone.
Talking about a revolution. It's finally the tables. I started.